A Young Immigrant's Take on America.
Sometimes it feels like, narratively speaking, we live in very binary moments where it's either or. Love it or leave it. You're with us or against us. And I just, maybe it's because the fiction writer's first mission is to find the good and the bad in every character. But that kind of speaking has never been what's excited me about America.
That's Boris Fishman. He talks about his terrific debut novel about coming of age in America. It's called A Replacement Life. And Obama just announced a Get Tough policy on carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. Now the question is, will he or won't he on the Keystone XL pipeline?
If we have changed our reality that we live in and we've changed our intentions for the future, would we still make the same decision that Bush and Cheney made, which would have certainly favored this pipeline and considered it to be a no-brainer?
That's John Cushman of Inside Climate News. He tells the story of how Obama got to this moment on the pipeline and where he might go in the future in his new ebook, Keystone and Beyond. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. America is a country of immigrants, as we like to remind ourselves, and nowhere is that more evident than in New York City. One of New York's most vibrant immigrant communities is in South Brooklyn, where many Jews in the former Soviet Union came to settle. My guest, Boris Fishman, immigrated to the U.S. with his parents when he was 9 years old. As readers of Fishman's fellow immigrant and author Gary Steingart know, there's a rich load of comedy and tragedy to be mined in the immigrant experience of Soviet Jews in America, one that Fishman takes full advantage of in his novel, A Replacement Life. The somewhat autobiographical protagonist is Slava, a young journalist on the make who, when his grandmother dies, finds himself reluctantly drawn back into the clutches of family and neighborhood. He becomes embroiled in a scheme by elderly Jewish emigres, led by his grandfather, to get restitution from the German government for being Holocaust victims, whether or not they fit the official requirements. It's loosely based on an actual scandal that came to light in 2009. Fishman's tangled tale illuminates the tender ambiguities of moral judgments and the murky compromises, as he calls them, between one's own needs and the needs of one's clan. I started out our conversation by asking him to tell us more about the protagonist. So your protagonist is Slava. Tell us about him, your fictional character.
Slava's young. In some ways, it is a very familiar form. It's the coming-of-age novel. It's a Bildungsroman. But for me, it's one of the most interesting questions I encountered in my 20s, which is, what does it mean to be a thinking person? What does it mean to be an adult? What does it mean to be a grown-up? And I wanted Slava, in the course of the novel, to find some answers to these questions. I also wanted him to get a lot of things wrong, because I got a lot of things wrong in my 20s, and I'm getting new things wrong in my 30s. And because I do believe in a literature of progress, I think in some books that I see, there's a real allergy to pointing a way forward by the author for his audience. But I grew up on the Russian novels of the 19th century, which did not shy away from prescriptions. And so I really believe in a literature of morality and progress, a literature that tries to point a way toward the light. But it would be equally false if that happened too quickly and too easily, because so much darkness has to be passed through in order to get to even an inkling of what the light is. The light is so hard won. But I think it's exceptionally cruel for books not to show that keyhole of light at the end. I'm not talking about a happy ending, not at all. I'm just talking about the character having banged his head against a number of walls, finally arriving at something resembling an understanding or an answer, probably a very different one than he or she hoped to find. That epitomizes Slava's experience.
And we'll talk about that experience in just a minute, but in this kind of moral story, this moral universe, first of all, I think what you're saying is it certainly contributed to the satisfaction that the reader has by the ending. And you also leave the reader a bit on tenterhooks. You're not sure what choices Slava is going to make by the end. But let's not keep our listeners too much in suspense. Tell us, what is the moral conundrum that this novel of Replacement Life centers around?
The moral conundrum is Slava Gelman is a 24-year-old young man who emigrated from the former Soviet Union at a young age and has been reared in a predominantly Russian-speaking neighborhood in South Brooklyn. But Slava, like any kid, like this kid in his first years in America, wants away from all that because, and here I speak of him as I do of myself, you're desperate to prove to yourself that you can be a full-fledged American. And you don't do that by sticking around in the old neighborhood and eating the food that they eat, listening to the music that they listen to, and so forth. However, Slava is very answerable to the expectations of his elders, which are the traditional immigrant expectations of traditional material progress in a profession that is safe, reliable, and so forth. Slava can't help the fact that he's interested in something else entirely, and what he's interested in is writing, and he has gotten a foothold in a very, very fancy magazine in Midtown Manhattan that is called Century.
And which sounds a lot like The New Yorker.
Where I worked when I was in my early 20s. Century does draw on my experience there, but since I freelanced a lot as a journalist and wrote for dozens of publications, it really amalgamates all that into that one magazine. The only problem is that Slava is just, he can't make it at Century. He's a researcher, he's not a writer, even though he's pretended to his family that he is in order to justify in their eyes this utterly bizarre professional choice. He can't figure out why. It makes him crazy. He tries so hard. And in one example of the ways in which some of the changes we sometimes try to make ourselves end up being quite superficial, sure, you can change boroughs. But if you're beholden to your parents' notion of success, it shows whether you're trying to become a doctor or a circus clown, you know? But anyway, the story doesn't really get going until Slava's grandmother, who has been ill for some time, passes away. He finds out very early one Sunday morning. And he is just overcome with incredible guilt because in the service of this, what is now feeling like a very misguided effort to Americanize himself, he has really abandoned his family. What I forgot to mention is that he has drawn a very firm line and has told his family not to be in touch and never returns to the old neighborhood and is just sort of waiting, as the novel says, for Russia to dialyze itself out of him. The way the toxins are dialyzed out of his grandmother's kidneys because she has cirrhosis of the liver.
And we have to say, not because she was an alcoholic.
Because she got a bad blood transfusion after a car accident in the former Soviet Union. And Slava returns to the neighborhood, shouldering this enormous burden of guilt. There, he meets his grandfather, who is in mourning, who gives him a truly Mephistophelian offer, which is Slava's grandmother is a Holocaust survivor, and she has just been informed that she's eligible to apply for restitution from the German government for reparations. The paperwork comes right around the time of her death because she dies somewhat abruptly. Now, I should mention that Soviet Jews, the Jews who emigrated from the former Soviet Union, were not eligible to apply for this restitution until they came to America. They could not apply. Actually, the agreements that were arrived with the German government as early as 1952 specifically excluded Soviet residing Jews from the agreements because it was believed that any money they received would be taken from them by the Soviet government, which may have been a reasonable concern. So people like my grandmother in real life, who also was a Holocaust survivor, did not become eligible until we arrived in the States, which in my case was in 1988. In any case, so she's finally authorized to receive these funds, to apply to receive these funds, just at the time that she passes away. And Slava's grandfather says, you know, that's our luck. You know, this woman endured the unspeakable, and this arrives right. He says, why don't you write it about me?
And tell us about him before you go too much further, because he's a marvelous character, and in many ways, the other protagonist of this book.
Yeah, the book is a tug of war between Slava and his grandfather. His grandfather is a shyster, a wheeler and dealer, a palm greaser, a guy who knows how to get things done. He's easily the most resourceful man, for better and worse, that Slava has ever known. Slava idolizes him and resents him completely. All the ways in which grandfather bent the law seemed incredibly justified in the Soviet Union, which was a country that was incredibly abusive of its citizens. And in some cases, it wasn't possible to get enough to live on without bending the rules. And the question then was simply, are you the kind of person who knows how to bend the rules to get what you need, or are you not? And it's not a question that many Americans ever have to face, because things rarely ever get so dire where you have to ask yourself, would I break this law to feed my child? Mm-hmm. That is a question that rarely comes up in a country like this one. And it used to come up a lot more often in that country. And grandfather always knew the answer to that question. And not only did he know it, he didn't have to think about it. And for better or worse, Slava is someone who always has to think about the answer to a question like that. So grandfather's mind, even in a time of great mourning, it is no infringement on his mourning for his mind to be spinning about how do we use this opportunity. And so he says to Slava, hey, it's 15,000 euros. Why don't you write it about me? And Slava says, but you weren't a survivor. You were evacuated. You spent the war in Uzbekistan in hiding. And grandfather says, you're a writer, aren't you? And Slava says, now I'm a writer. Because until then, it was a cause, it was a family tragedy that Slava had elected to do what he had done. It was a cause for a rift in the family. And that's what gets the story going. Slava, savoring his power over grandfather, Slava refuses, high-handedly refuses to do anything like that. He claims for moral reasons, but that's not why. He finally has something he can say no to. He finally has something that he can deny grandfather. Usually they're the ones denying him the approval from them that he so desperately craves. Now he has something to deny them. However, the problem is that Slava, through this offer, gets an opportunity to be the lionized writer that he never gets in Manhattan. And also he gets an opportunity through these false letters to recreate on the page the grandmother that he never really knew in real life. And that's what he ends up doing.
And in so doing, it affects a transformation also in him. In some ways, he begins to channel his grandmother. I mean, he begins this novel in as a very self-involved young guy. You can understand the reasons why he's doing things, but he's not particularly sympathetic. And this really affords him an opportunity to traverse the territory between his new life and his old life, between his new country and his old country. Talk a little bit more about how that happens in his rediscovery of the history of his family.
Well, the very first thing that, you know, a novel that you mean to appeal to people probably ought to have is a likable protagonist. But the fact was that Slava is not particularly likable when you start the novel, because he is self-involved. He's very earnest. He's not trying to hurt people, but he's got blinders on. And he thinks he knows everything there is to know about the Russian community that he comes from. They are narrow-minded. They're parochial. They are unsophisticated. They're clannish, materialistic. They've come to America and have done nothing they've made an effort to learn nothing about their adopted country. They cluster in this neighborhood that America has enabled them to never have to leave, except for the DMV, as the novel says. And they've just exploited it to remain unperturbed by the larger doings of the country that's adopted them, that he, in his very, you know, high-minded way, thinks is shameful. But this scheme of grandfather's draws him back into the neighborhood, which he otherwise would not have returned to without a reason like that.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Boris Fishman about his novel, A Replacement Life. And we should explain also that his grandfather tells others about what he's asking his grandson to do. And so then Slava becomes besieged by all kinds of other people who want him to write their narratives.
He becomes the forger of South Brooklyn. Because when they're done, Slava says, look me in the eyes and swear that this stays between us. Grandfather looks, grandfather swears. The next morning he calls a friend and says, look what happened here. You want? Basically, Slava learns that he knew nothing about what it means to be Russian, and he also knew nothing about what it means to be American. Yes, and now I'm speaking as Boris Fishman. Soviet emigres are all those things. In many ways, they are trauma victims. They were traumatized for decades by an insane country. It was insane in almost every way. And now they come to a quote-unquote normal place, and it is impossible for them to function here like normal people. This is why it takes generations. At the same time, they're warm, they're gregarious, they're quick to intimacy, and they bear loads of history on their backs that America has been blessed and cursed never to encounter.
And you say Russians, but this is also particularly a Russian Jewish history as well. For our listeners, just see if sketch a little bit about what life was like for Russian Jews, you know, in the latter part of the 20th century before the Soviet Union became Russia.
Well, the best way is to tell a couple of stories. My mother went to Belarus State. I'm from Minsk, the capital of Belarus, and the main university in Belarus, which is now an independent country of 10 million people, so you can get an idea of the premier higher educational institution was Belarus State University. Now, they had a quota, an unofficial quota for Jews. It was unofficial because, in an incredible gesture of hypocrisy, officially the Soviet Union was the most egalitarian state in the world, and they advertised it and brandished it at every opportunity. The fact was they had quotas in place for how many Jews could get into, because Jews were always seen as a fifth column. If you're Jewish, you can't possibly be a patriot. You must be an ally of Israel rather than of the Soviet Union. Therefore, you were suspect. It's an incredibly medieval way of thinking, but that's the way this modern state conducted itself. So my mother, so I don't know what the quota was, 5 per 1,000, 10 per 1,000, I don't know. She got in. Not only did she get in, she became valedictorian. However, it's quite unseemly, isn't it, from the perspective of the Ministry of Education, that one of the 10 out of 1,000 Jews that's admitted becomes valedictorian. We can't have that. So we have to make her salutatorian. At which point my grandfather, my real-life grandfather, had to bribe the Minister of Education, whom he knew, of course, because they had dealt on so many other things, in order to do the right thing and give my mother the valedictorian spot, which she got, ultimately, in a great exception to what would otherwise happen. You can imagine what would have happened if my grandfather didn't have those connections. So from something that grand to something utterly daily, you could be in a grocery store and you could be looking at a loaf of bread, and the cashier calls out for the entire store to hear, "Stop working over that bread with your grubby Jewish fingers," for everyone to hear. For some reason, in that country at that time, perhaps because there was so little to go around, an incredible proportion of people made themselves feel better about what their lives were like by putting down people in a harder spot. So both legally and socially, you felt incredibly unwelcome all the time. That's what it meant to be Jewish in the Soviet Union. You know, the particular shade of it changed when the Russian Empire became the Soviet Union, and some periods were better than others, but that was the norm.
There's a marvelous scene in the book, and I don't want to really give too much away, so I'm going to try to couch this. But there's a certain scene in the book where Slava gets to tell somebody that in spite of the fact that these narratives are forged or false, that they really are talking about a much deeper truth. And I wonder if you could talk about that deeper truth, because you've also written about that in your journalism, about your real family, about the suffering of Jews during the Holocaust and what was allowed in as true suffering and what was not.
I'm really glad you picked up on that, because that is a very dear subject to me. Because the argument that grandfather makes to Slava is, yes, I did not suffer in the exact way I need to have suffered in order to qualify. But you're telling me I didn't suffer? Mm-hmm. Yes, I was evacuated. But like, you think that was a cup of tea? And you think I took myself to Uzbekistan? No, it was because Minsk was the first city to be invaded by the Germans. Which gets the conversation going about this fact that, you know, in real life, these restitution agreements, they've changed over time. Initially, you had to have been an inmate of a ghetto for 18 months in order to qualify. With time, that became 6 months. With time, that became 3 months. So what was illegal yesterday is legal today, which for me only underscores the fact that these rules are made by human beings who are hardly sinless and hardly objective. Now, as one of the characters in the novel says, we must abide by the law because that is all there is. If our choice is between law and lawlessness, we must choose the law. But the novel also wishes to say that there's often quite some distance between law and truth or law and justice. And if no acknowledgement of that can be made legally, perhaps we can make acknowledgement of it morally or poetically within the covers of a novel. The things that I described in the novel, I invented them, but then they came true a year after I started writing. I began writing the novel in November 2009. In November 2010, there was an article in the New York Times talking about how the FBI and the district attorney's office discovered a ring of people in South Brooklyn. My novel is set in Bensonhurst and Midwood. This was in Brighton Beach, the well-known Russian neighborhood, who were doing exactly what I described in the novel and had been defrauding the Claims Conference, which is the organization that administers these funds, for, at that point, over 10 years. And so it's not like this story has owned the headlines, but there seems to be no doubt, if you read the comments that follow the reporting on this, there's no kindness there for the people who did this. And it's true that some of them are simply people looking to make a buck. But I happen to know a lot of people like the people who did this. And I can tell you from personal experience that they're not evil. Mm-hmm. They're trauma victims. They endured unspeakable things. They're not the things that they have been entitled to get restituted, but they feel they're owed by life. And in fact, the people who owe them the most, which is the former Soviets, are not offering. Okay, so the Germans are offering. Mm-hmm. Their moral lines are not fine. If we must come to a legal judgment about them, let there be no doubt. They must be prosecuted and sent to prison. But if we were to speak of morals, I'm more interested in an understanding of the context than of a kind of black and white approach. And so the novel tries to get into that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Boris Fishman about his terrific debut novel, A Replacement Life, out from HarperCollins.
I mean, you point out in the example of the novel that somebody who was a partisan, who suffered in unspeakable privations in the woods, escaped from the Minsk ghetto and fought the Germans as a partisan and not particularly welcomed by the partisans either, would not have qualified for this.
Yeah, the partisans are the guerrilla fighters, the bands of guerrilla fighters that formed. Belarus, especially Western Belarus and Eastern Poland, is very dense with woods that the Germans themselves did not like to enter. And they were the basis of operation for these guerrilla bands, which was actually the subject of a movie called Defiance that came out a couple of years ago. But many of these bands, they were anti-fascist, but they were not pro-Jewish. They were still filled with Russians who often had anti-Semitic characteristics. And so indeed, if you were a Red Army soldier and you had three limbs blown off during the war, you're not eligible. Mm-hmm. You're eligible only in certain circumstances. Part of the reason that I spent so much time dwelling on this is because, now don't get me wrong, the Soviet Union was a police state. It was a totalitarian state. At the same time, a certain lawlessness pervaded it, where by definition, you needed to go around the rules in order to acquire basic things. Mm-hmm. And you lived in a society because of this, and who knows where the chicken was and where the egg, but you lived in a society where the citizens constantly suspected each other of being on the make in some undeclared way, and the government always suspected it of you, so that everyone everywhere was guilty until proven innocent. You come to America, which is the opposite, and you're innocent. You know, I had this conversation once with the person I was dating then, and I said to her, it is incredible to me, you are really sort of coy in telling your friends about like what you're up to and when you're available. You don't feel obligated to declare to them the full story of your doings and goings and things like that. But you would never, ever lie to the government about anything. Whereas me, I would never dare to not disclose fully to my friends everything that I'm up to and everything that I'm doing. Whereas the idea of lying to the government is much more acceptable to me. And she was American and I was not. There is just a completely understandable and actually really, really beautiful tendency among Americans to observe the law even when they have nothing concrete and immediate to gain from it. What if you're a Jew in Germany in 1937? What if you're a Soviet in the Soviet Union in 1952 right before Stalin died, when he was planning a deportation of Jews. Is it proper to be law-abiding then?
Boris Fishman, you've written a piece about what happens when the country that you came from no longer exists. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what is it like when the country that you called home no longer exists and you have a country that you weren't born in that has become your home.
I have all kinds of friends who live binational lives. One of my closest friends is Macedonian, and in fact, his business deals with Macedonian imports. So he's there every other week the way that, I don't know, I go to New Jersey to see my parents. And to me, nothing could seem less possible. When we left the Soviet Union, which was in 1988, there was no indication to people at our level, which is to say ordinary citizens, that it was at risk of ending anytime soon. We were saying goodbye forever. And we were treated like we were saying goodbye forever. We endured rituals of excommunication at our workplaces. I'm speaking now of my parents. I was 9 years old. We were made to pay retroactively for the free educations we'd received. We were allowed to take with us 90 rubles worth of personal possessions. Imagine packing centuries of existence into $90 per person, which is what the exchange rate at the time was 1-to-1. Imagine sweating your way through customs because under the top button of your shirt, your mother has hidden a family heirloom necklace that goes above the limit. We were saying goodbye forever. And then once we came to America, even after the Soviet Union unraveled, there was probably no place that we wanted to go to less. It was so awful to us. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's no surprise when I tell you that I became obsessed with the former Soviet Union, which led me to major in Slavic literature in college, and which led me to go to Moscow for a summer to see for myself what it was like. It was a miserable experience. I hated being in Russia. I was in a place that was small-minded, xenophobic, miserable, aggressive. It may be very different now. This was in 2000, but Russians, the Russians I met tended to be incredibly generous and charitable to foreigners and incredibly vicious to their own. As I wrote in one of my book reviews once, no one eats their own the way Russia does. So I've had much more charming experiences in other parts of the former Soviet Union since, but there's really no fondness in me for Russia whatsoever. For example, Ukraine I found to be much more affecting and warm and pleasant than my travels in Russia. So both because we thought it was the end and because there has been no sweetness to returning, that whole path is closed. Mm-hmm. None of that is to say that this feels like home. I'm a fully functioning American, but the way I interact with people, the way I identify family relations, the kind of relationship I would like to have with my partner in life, so many of my instincts remain European rather than American. A society so centrally devoted to profit as the primary motive of existence. Now it actually has a lot of extremely beneficial qualities that were a wonder to me to learn about. When there is money to be made, it's less productive to kill all the Jews in your country. Let's not bother with that. There's money to be made. Minorities get hurt when majorities need to take out anger because of reduced circumstances. And I don't think I would ever leave this soil for good. But there are certain things about this culture, primarily financial and interpersonal, let's say, that have never made perfect sense to me. And even as I remain so grateful, in a really broad historical sense, that the Fishmans were taken in by America, it would be a lie to say that I have felt at home here in every way. And also, just to finish, I want to live in a country where it's possible to say this doesn't work for me and this doesn't work for me and still have heard how much love you have for the country. Sometimes it feels like, narratively speaking, we live in very binary moments where it's either or, love it or leave it, you're with us or against us. And I just, maybe it's because the fiction writer's first mission is to find the good and the bad in every character. But that kind of speaking has never been what's excited me about America.
Mm-hmm. Your novel, A Replacement Life, does really elucidate those moral ambiguities to find a deeper human truth. And I know that that kind of sounds a little formulaic, but it's not. I was very moved by the book, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. It's just been a fascinating discussion.
And for me, too. It's been on such a high level, and I'm so grateful for this conversation. Thank you.
Boris Fishman. You can find links to his reporting on the actual case of fraudulent claims for Holocaust restitution by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Keystone and Beyond. We talk with Inside Climate News reporter John Cushman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On June 2nd, Obama announced a major new rule on climate policy. It sent a signal that the U.S. may finally be getting ready to do something about global warming. But Obama has another major decision on the climate coming up, one he's delayed until after the midterm elections. That's the decision on whether to approve building the northern section of the Keystone XL pipeline. If that's built, it'll join the southern section to carry highly polluting tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to ports on the Gulf Coast. Will he or won't he? That's the big question. My guest John Cushman recently published the e-book Keystone and Beyond, subtitled Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. The book delves into the history leading up to the decision Obama has yet to make. It gives the reader the context to understand the forces weighing on that decision from all sides. I spoke with Cushman last week, just a few days before Monday's momentous decision on coal plants, and that came into our conversation as well. Cushman begins his book by going back to the administration of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. I asked him why he started there.
At the outset of this project, I happened to be reading a wonderful book by Richard Neustadt called Thinking in Time, a political science classic about presidential decision-making. And his key advice was go back to the beginning and figure out how you got to the point. Don't start a decision-making process with a list of options. Start it with a timeline that tells you how you got to the point where you're confronting a particular decision. So I went back to the very early days of the tar sands expansion in Canada, which happened to coincide with the election in 2000 and coming into office in 2001 of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And I remembered and went back and refreshed my memory that they came into office with energy and energy security being very high on their agenda. Remember, this was before the attacks of September 11th in 2001. And what I learned was that they came into office with a set of assumptions and a set of expectations that were radically different than the ones that President Obama faces today. And I'll give you one quick example. When they came into office, practically the first policy thing that they did was to have a new energy policy. By May, a few months after being sworn in, Dick Cheney was presenting this new energy policy. And it was premised on one basic idea, that the demand for oil in the United States was going to be going up 25% in the next 25 years, and that our production of oil had peaked and was going to be going down for that whole time. So therefore, we really needed, they felt, a reliable source to feed this inexorable demand since we didn't have energy of our own. Now, today, the opposite has turned out to be true. The demand for oil in the United States began going down 6 or 7 years ago and is going to continue to go down. And the supply of domestically produced oil has suddenly exploded to the point that we're headed toward being a net exporter of oil and natural gas and the leading producer of oil and natural gas ahead of Saudi Arabia, ahead of Russia. So those two key premises on which their entire policy was built, including the policy of expanding access to Canadian tar sands, turned out not to be true. Now, at the same time, something else changed dramatically since those days. President Bush and President Cheney, whatever they might have said about climate policy, always emphasized the uncertainty of whether climate change was a reality, of how imminent its risks were, and about whether we needed to do anything dramatic to head it off. And they never agreed that there should be an international framework which would require all nations to reduce their use of fossil fuels. Today, Barack Obama takes exactly the opposite point of view. On one particular after another, we're going to see it again on Monday when he issues coal power plant regulations that the Bush administration refused to ever approach. And so not only are the facts of our energy supply and demand different, but the entire way of thinking about climate change and energy has changed dramatically. And so my book traces those developments over 10 or 15 years and leads you ultimately to your answer to the question, if we have changed our reality that we live in and we've changed our intentions for the future, would we still make the same decision that Bush and Cheney made, which would have certainly favored this pipeline and considered it to be a no-brainer?
The world is looking to Obama to see what decision, how he will lay out the energy policy. Before we go back to Keystone, I wonder if you could just comment a little bit on the import of this decision for tackling climate change.
Yes. The rule that President Obama is going to be announcing on Monday is a very narrow rule, although it affects a large amount of carbon dioxide. It's really only about the use of coal in existing power plants in the United States. The big question that the world needs to address faces a deadline at the end of next year, at the end of 2015, and that is, can the world's nations come together and agree on limits to greenhouse gas emissions that will put us on a path to zero carbon energy futures within the next 40, 50, 60, maybe 80 years? Can we steer ourselves to a place in which we can keep the atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide within safe climate limits? And those limits, we're approaching those limits very fast. The scientists tell us that to have a reasonable chance of getting away with 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which is where the biggest risks start to occur, we need to stabilize carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at a number of about 450 parts per million. We've just blown through 400 parts per million. We're only 10 or 20 years away from hitting that wall. And so the world's institutions, the international institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they all have come to the view that there's a carbon budget that the planet has to get on. And that means deep reductions in carbon emissions over the next 40 or 50 years, really severe reductions of carbon emissions. Now, if we are to commit to something of that kind, there's really not going to be a place for further expansion of one of the dirtiest, most carbon-intense forms of energy that we have on the planet, that is the Canadian tar sands. All the economic modeling shows that if you're serious about staying on the carbon budget or the carbon diet, as some people would call it, you need to leave 80% of our fossil fuels in the ground. And if you're going to leave 80% of them in the ground, you would probably most like to leave the dirtiest ones in the ground. In a world like that, where we're being serious about addressing climate change, U.S. petroleum consumption is going to plummet. And there would be not only no need for further imports of petroleum, but the prices of oil would go down because demand was so low, and there would be no economic feasibility to developing these very costly resources in Canada. And so in a world where Canada and the United States and the other countries of the world are all committed to addressing climate change seriously, expansion of the tar sands just really doesn't make sense. And in that situation, it's foolish to build a multi-billion dollar project that lasts 50 years and that locks in the funnel for delivering this fuel to the world's markets. So it's not so much a question of what does Keystone and the tar sands mean for climate. It's what does our commitment to tackle climate change mean for projects like Keystone and the tar sands.
And that feeds right into my next question, and perhaps you've already answered it. And that is, you say that for reasons both symbolic and practical, Keystone XL has become a turning point on the nation's path toward the new realities of energy and climate. So I want you to parse that. Symbolic and practical?
Right. The symbolic value of Keystone is manifested in its ability to galvanize a public movement to take a particular step against climate change. Nobody opposes the Keystone pipeline on the grounds that if we stop this pipeline, we will have solved the climate change problem. There's a lot of carbon that's going to move through that pipeline over the years. The EPA estimates it's about 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide more than if we were using alternative fuels instead. If you take all the fuel that's going to move through this pipeline and add up the consequences of burning it, it comes out to more like 6 or 8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. So that's as much carbon dioxide as we're saving through all the new modern, clean, fuel-efficient cars that are going to be built over the next 20 years. So it's significant, but it's nowhere near enough to solve the climate change problem. The climate change problem is caused by the accumulation of carbon dioxide over a century and the rapid expansion of our fossil fuel use over the coming decades. And no one pipeline is going to solve the problem. However, what this pipeline has managed to do is to galvanize a public movement and to inform a public in opposition to excessive use of carbon and in opposition to one decision after another that needs to be made, because there are countless decisions that need to be made in order to meet the broad objective of getting to zero carbon from fossil fuel use. And that's not a pie-in-the-sky target. Zero carbon from fossil fuel use is the objective that the Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has called for. This is the economic decision-making body of the leading industrialized nations. This is not the Sierra Club talking. And so those who study climate most carefully and see the choices that lie ahead, as does, for example, the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, comes out with a formulation like the National Academies. You have to think very carefully about committing yourself to large infrastructure projects which lock in steady carbon emissions, because the more carbon dioxide that's emitted, the higher the risks are, and every ton counts. And there's a carbon budget that that the world needs to adhere to. You can't get to that carbon budget by building, building, and building.
Yeah, and I want to point out, by the way, that I live in a community, East Hampton, New York, that has just, the town council has just passed a decision to go completely 100% renewable in electricity generation by 2020, only 6 years away, and by 2030 to be have the equivalent of 100% renewables in all forms of power.
I wasn't aware of that. That's very interesting. You know, many states and local governments are moving in comparable directions. I heard the governor of Massachusetts declare the other day that within 4 years, Massachusetts electrical supplies should be coal-free. And so it is possible for small decisions like this to add up, and each one of them does have a contribution, and that's the way the Keystone Pipeline should be looked at. It is the case that if Canada is committed to doubling and redoubling and always expanding its tar sands output, that it will need pipelines, and that if you approve this one pipeline on the basis that just one pipeline doesn't make any difference, then the same basis on which you approved the previous pipeline and the one before it, then how could you ever get to the point of deciding that a pipeline should be rejected? And so while going after a pipeline is in some ways a very narrow and limited decision, in other ways it's a fundamental decision. It's a decision that says we're now going to address infrastructure projects in a way that takes the big picture of climate change into account. Now, on a practical level, this is an important decision as well, because the United States needs to decide whether it's in its interest to have this pipeline built. And one of the questions that has arisen as the world has changed under our feet is that there's really no need anymore for domestic access to this oil. This oil would be piped to the Gulf. It would be refined, and the refined products would largely, not entirely, but would largely be exported. It may be in the U.S. interest to have some jobs as the middleman in this global transaction to take Canadian tar sands and get them to China. But at the same time, there are considerable risks involved. And, having a pipeline through your community or across your landscape is not a risk-free event. And there are costs that are imposed. And so what my book is trying to do is to find a way of thinking through these things more holistically and recognizing both the risks as well as the supposed rewards and the costs as well as the benefits, and to make sure that we think completely about this action as not something that's happening at one moment in time, but something that has occurred over the span of 15 years of deliberations, to make sure that you come to your thinking about this project with the whole picture in front of you.
Right, and you do provide that picture, John Cushman, in your book, Keystone and Beyond. In fact, I want to go back even before the Dick Cheney's Energy Policy Committee, the one that was done in so much secrecy that the National Resources Defense Council had to sue to get the minutes to even find out who was there, and I think it was just the oil and gas folks who were there. I want to go back to the campaign before that, where Bush himself was saying that with the help of Congress, environmental groups and industry, we will require all power plants to meet clean air standards in order to reduce emissions of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, and carbon dioxide within a reasonable period of time. Now, we're talking George W. Bush. Is that right?
That's right. He made that promise in the campaign during the year 2000. And he expressly said that the mechanism that he would choose to do that would be a cap-and-trade bill. But it was only a few weeks into office that Vice President Cheney took an end run around that policy. Bush's environmental administrator, Christy Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey, was off in Europe repeating the promise to European countries that the U.S. was going to step up and regulate the emissions, the carbon emissions of coal-fired power plants. And when she got back, she found that the president had signed a letter to Senator Hagel and a handful of other senators saying that, in his view, carbon dioxide was not a pollutant and that there would be other ways of addressing emissions of carbon dioxide other than the Clean Air Act. Throughout the Bush administration, even when his own EPA administrators recommended that that carbon dioxide be recognized as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act and dealt with accordingly, the Bush administration was vehement in its opposition to this. Again, despite a campaign promise to the contrary, he flat out changed his tune. Only when the Obama administration came into office did they go through the series of steps, an endangerment finding showing that carbon dioxide was presenting a danger to public health and to natural ecosystems. Subsequent to that endangerment finding, regulatory action against mobile sources of carbon dioxide in the form of fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. And once they had taken that step of controlling emissions from automobiles under the Clean Air Act, it became incumbent upon them under the law to also address stationary sources for the sake of even-handedness, stationary sources meaning factories, smokestacks, and power plants. The Supreme Court has endorsed this approach repeatedly. It's been challenged repeatedly in the courts, but the EPA has a very strong track record of prevailing in this kind of litigation. And so throughout the Obama administration, on the question of whether carbon dioxide is a pollutant and needs to be addressed both in mobile and stationary sources as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, the Obama administration has been determined and taking the exact opposite approach as the Bush administration. So here's another instance in which their whole environmental gestalt is opposite to the Bush administration's, which leaves one asking once again, why, if you have a completely opposite set of premises about the pollutant that we're talking about here, would you manage to reach the exact same decision that the previous administration was reaching on similar pipelines? Because the previous administration approved Keystone One, approved the Alberta Clipper Line, or set it up for approval, and clearly believed in the perpetual expansion of access by the United States to the Canadian tar sands. There's very little, if President Obama were to decide to approve this pipeline and continue this march toward expansion of Canada's tar sands, it would be a real outlier in any comparison of his track record on carbon pollution to the Bush administration's track record.
Except for the fact that he has approved new oil drilling in the Gulf and other places, and also has been full speed ahead on gas fracking, and has tried to really not deal with the issue of methane leaks, which release an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. So, you know,
well, there are those who see failings in his approach, and I don't think it's quite as cut and dried as you have put it, but for sure, the administration, which just today put out from its Council on Economic Advisers yet another defense of its all-of-the-above energy policies, they definitely do believe that the expansion of fossil fuel production in the oil patch and in natural gas has been an economic benefit, and they are indeed pursuing the possibility of natural gas exports. While they do take the posture that they want this done only in the most environmentally responsible way, they are definitely open to criticism that they've gone overboard for the kind of drill baby drill approach. I would say it's more of a mixed record than a black and white record, but one of the things that you will find reading my book is that throughout this period in which he was taking, at least at a rhetorical level, and in some cases at a fundamental level, taking steps to rein in carbon dioxide pollution, Obama always carried some ambivalence about this question. And I think that it's his ambivalence that has put him in a spot where he might decide to give a green light to the Keystone. I think for those who want to see a decision against the Keystone, the brighter spot has been Secretary Kerry coming to the State Department, where the decision-making authority is delegated, or the recommendation will come from. This will be Obama's decision, but Kerry is certainly a big player. And Kerry's record on these issues is unambiguous. I mean, he's going to have a hard time looking at himself in the mirror if he decides that the Keystone is an exception to the kind of rules that have guided him throughout his long Senate career and as a person who's got to lead the negotiations on climate change leading up to Paris in 2015.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Cushman about his new ebook from Inside Climate News, Keystone and Beyond. You can find it at insideclimatenews.org. So Kerry is going to have to make this decision because this is, after all, an international boundary that's being crossed. These tar sands are in Canada, the Alberta tar sands, although we have tar sands in the U.S. that are being developed, also in North Dakota. Talk a little bit about Canada and what happened there. What were the politics that allowed Canada to go from, you know, a fairly environmentally forward-thinking country when it came to the Kyoto Protocol to where it is now being branded a climate criminal? And maybe fold into that also, you know, what would happen if Obama decided against the pipeline? The argument that's being made by the oil and gas industry and by Canada itself is that they're going to continue to produce no matter what.
Well, that's a big, complicated question, and Canada is a big, complicated country as well. The tar sands reserves in Alberta belong to the people of Alberta, not to the people of Canada. And Alberta is, in a way, like the Texas of Canada. They're distinct among Canadian provinces. At the same time, Canada has gone back and forth over the years between liberal and conservative governments. And the current government is very conservative. The current prime minister came to office viewing the Kyoto Protocol to control global warming as a kind of socialist plot to redistribute the world's wealth, and has done precious little to encourage movement toward a real commitment to address climate change. Canada has done quite a few things to address climate change. Canadian provinces have done quite a bit. British Columbia has a very effective carbon tax. Ontario has completely eliminated coal from its generating mix, although they have a big hydro resource and a lot of nuclear, so they were able to do that more simply than other places might. So these are big, complicated questions. Now, in Alberta, the development of the tar sands is viewed as an economic imperative because Alberta has a royalty scheme that one day, once it finally starts collecting from the oil companies, once they have soaked up the subsidies that are presented at the front end of this process, one day Alberta expects to get trillions of dollars in oil revenues. And they do get royalty money that makes a difference in their budget every year. But the real profits of this enterprise go not to Alberta, but to international oil companies. So you have the imperative caused by the exercise of economic influence by the oil companies. Canada can say that it wants, or at least its conservative federal government wants to develop pipelines, but they have to deal with the indigenous peoples. The First Nations of Canada have a great deal of say over what happens on their territory, and these pipelines have to cross their territory, and they're not trustful of the pipeline companies. So British Columbia, where you know, one pipeline route might end up coming out to provide access to the Pacific markets, is not interested in oil tanker risks to its coastal ecosystems. And so there are questions about that. And then finally, to take the attitude that says it doesn't matter what the United States does about the Keystone Pipeline, and in some sense it doesn't matter. These are Canada's resources. But to say we, Canada, are going to double and redouble this production regardless of that pipeline decision is, in effect, to say Canada is no longer willing to meet its commitments to the UN climate change process. Canada has made the same commitments that the United States has made to reduce its emissions. And the only reason that Canada is not achieving its emissions targets is because of the growing production of tar sands oil in Alberta. That's the one thing that is stopping Canada from meeting these obligations. And so if we construct a world in which nations are not going to commit themselves to emissions that are consistent with a safe climate outcome, then, yeah, things will go their merry way. And you know, we would also have unfettered burning of coal in U.S. power plants if we had no concerns about meeting our commitments to climate change targets. But the risks of such an approach, when nation after nation after nation holds it to be itself to be the exception, can continue to follow the business as usual course, the results of that are a warming of 4 degrees, 6 degrees, 8 degrees Celsius. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, and I can't predict exactly what the outcomes are going to be, but it is very clear that we're already seeing the signs of anthropogenic climate change and that we're confronting risks that are going to be borne by future generations.
Climate reporter John Cushman. Find a link to his latest article where he analyzes the new EPA rule on carbon pollution at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Liannon.